Discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Reverend Julie Ryan, who is the interim pastor at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church and Lutheran Campus Center at the University of Illinois. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. We're going to be talking about Bread and Roses. Now, that title may mystify some of our listeners, so let's try to explain what that's about. Justice and Beauty. Now, I first came up with that title because I saw in your office when I was welcoming you to campus earlier this semester a license plate that had Bread and Roses 2. Tell us about that.
Yeah, BRDROS 2, my subtle social justice statement. Bread and Roses comes from a song that was written after the textile workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts went on strike in 1912. Someone saw a sign, Bread and Roses, and James Oppenheim wrote the poem, wrote the song, Bread for All and Roses Too, a slogan of the women in the West. And the reason I love it is that it combines the need for beautiful things in our lives along with a living wage, bread on the table, the things that we need, what we want as well as what we need.
So justice and beauty.
Here's part of the way the song goes. As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lots gray, are touched by all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. And I'll skip, but our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing, their ancient call for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits knew. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. And the last line looks forward to a day, a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses. So the glorious things of life are sometimes the most simple as well.
So many of the textile workers in this country, well, and in fact around the world, have been women. And it's interesting that in that strike in 1912 in Massachusetts, it was women who were striking and holding up these signs asking for justice, but also beauty in their lives. As a pastor who's female, you're an interim pastor at St. Andrew's. Tell us what that means. Some of our listeners may not know that term. What is an interim pastor?
Well, it's not because I'm female that I'm an interim,
no,
and vice versa.
That. Of course.
I'll give you a hard time on
of
that.
Course.
An interim pastor is someone who's like a long-term substitute and a transition specialist. And you come in between what interim pastors like to call settled pastors. Pastor John Sutherland had been the campus pastor for the ELCA Lutherans for the last 15 years. He's just retired, or so he says. And he's been commissioned by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the ELCA, to be a missionary at Reformation Lutheran Church in Beit Jala, the West Bank. And so he's over there.
In Palestine.
Yeah, uh-huh. So he's over there teaching music and English and serving at the parish. And I'm here to be the pastor of St. Andrew's, which is an ELCA congregation. It's a student-led congregation. While the lay leadership undergoes the call process and interviews candidates and, you know, discovering what we need to do to put things in place for the new settled pastor.
Now, what does it mean when you say that St. Andrew's Lutheran Church is a student-led congregation? It's right here on the campus of the University of Illinois on Wright Street, right across from Lincoln Hall. But in what sense is it student-led?
Well, there are two. It was formed as a student congregation of the predecessor church bodies that went into the formation of the ELCA. It was formed as a congregation in 1978 after having been designated a preaching point of the then Lutheran congregations in town. And amusingly, it was designated as an unofficially as an abnormal congregation. That was so it wouldn't be a threat to anybody else. But campus ministry among Lutherans has been going on at UIUC since 1911 and was behind the formation of Grace Lutheran Church because somebody from the agricultural school wrote in distressed at the plight of Lutheran students who were languishing without a place to go to church. So the Lutherans met in various places, including McKinley and the Y, until Christmas Eve of 1946, when someone bought the house at the corner of Wright and Chalmers, which belonged to the dean of the law school, E.O. Harker. And then in 1956, that was replaced by our current building. But it took some time then. There was always a worshiping community from 1946 onward, but we just gathered for word and sacrament. We weren't supposed to have any baptisms, marriages, other things. And there was a kind of a funny relationship where you weren't supposed to be a member there. You were supposed to be counted as a member at one of the other congregations. We're not sure the people ever got onto the rolls of the other congregations. But in 1978, we became a full-fledged congregation. A specialized academic congregation, that was the official term. Okay. And what that means is that it's never expected to be completely self-supporting. It is a mission of the church, and the governance comes both from a council of student leaders with a couple of elder statespeople, not in the Presbyterian sense of elder, more in the age sense of elder. And they provide for program, but then financial oversight and care for the property are in the hands of the Board of Trustees, which come from lay and clergy people from surrounding congregations. So the programming, the leadership really does come from students.
This university has an interesting history in terms of religious groups because it's a state-supported institution. Of course, it can have no formal relationship with different religious groups, but because an early dean of students, Dean Thomas Arkell Clark, back at the beginning of the 1900s, encouraged religious groups to buy property near the university and to provide opportunities for students to do service and worship and fellowship and those sorts of things, because he thought that the religious life of students should be able to continue if they chose to do that. And so it was really with his encouragement that some of the early churches, including the Lutherans, came to this campus and bought property right on the edge of the quadrangle, as it turned out to be. But as a result, we have on this campus, for example, the very first Methodist Wesley Foundation in the world, and we have the very first Hillel Foundation for Jewish students anywhere in the world. Just in the last 10 years, we now have the first Muslim mosque at a state university. So because of that early history, which was mainly Protestant Christian, now it's become very interfaith. And so the Lutherans were one of the early ones here responding to Dean Clark's invitation to do that.
Well, and as a matter of fact, the ELCA is getting ready in 2007 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Lutheran campus ministry in this country, which started at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, 1907.
I see. Let me encourage listeners who'd like to make a phone call and join this conversation. This is a live program every Sunday night from 5 to 6 p.m. Central Standard Time these days. And folks who'd like to call in can do that anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet. You may call us 1-800-222-9455. That's a toll-free call for people outside of Champaign-Urbana. If you're listening in Champaign-Urbana, do use a local number, 333-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. And I see we have a caller already on one of our lines. Line number one, go ahead, please.
Hi, I just wanted to say how much I'm enjoying Beauty and Roses. I believe in Beauty and Roses. I worship at Wesley Methodist Church. Anyway, my question to your speaker, to your guest, is that I know the Whirlpool Project is being good neighbors. Do you think Beauty and Roses has to do with being good neighbors? Now hang up and listen to your answer.
Thank you very much. Yes, I did hear. Thank you very much for calling.
Yes.
So,
well, a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses. There's some speculation about where that phrase came from. You may be aware of the phrase hyacinths to feed the soul, and there's a rhyming couplet which I don't have in front of me, but we think it comes from a 13th century Persian poet where if you're down to your last two coins, use one to buy the loaf of bread and use the other one to buy hyacinths to feed the soul. So the need for, we do not live by bread alone. It's a human need to have beauty and expression of what's most meaningful in life. Look back to cave paintings. As long as we've been human, people have needed to express their relationship to what is ultimate. And I think that the realm of the arts and the different ways we have a symbolic self-expression are certainly a connection that could be explored and a way that we connect with people not only of other denominations but other faiths and people of no particular faith.
And the caller mentioned the local Whirlwind Project. It is an interfaith project that uses things like art and theater and music and other things, dance, to explore different themes across interfaith lines. And so some of those projects will be coming up again next spring. We have another caller waiting on one of the local lines, line number two. Yes, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
I want to comment on the, I'm impressed with your visitor's knowledge of the campus branch of the ECLA. I also wanted to make a comment on your statements, Mr. Shoemaker, about the role of Thomas Arkell Clark. It seems to me that the problem the response of the various denominational churches in the United States was far more important than anything that Clark did to get the various churches around the campus to meet the needs of students. There was, as you say, this suspicion about the local churches losing members if you got campus churches. And one of the most active persons in getting started was a Methodist minister, the predecessor of present Methodist Church. I forget his name offhand, but he was extremely effective.
It might have been Paul Burt?
No, it was much before that.
Before that, I'm sorry.
Okay. But all of the churches, the Presbyterians, the Lutherans didn't get in the act so quickly. The Methodists were very, very prominent. Of course, the Catholics, the Jews, they all felt that at that time there was a feeling that religion was inseparable from education, and if the a university didn't teach or offer religion courses, then the church had to follow its students. So this is a very, very broad movement, and I would not like to see Clark get
too much
more
credit. You would not like to see him get too much credit.
That's
I understand.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And since I recognize your voice, may I identify you as the historian of the university?
You may, if you wish.
Professor Winton Solberg.
That's correct.
Yes.
Right.
Well, you literally have written the book and are writing, volume 3 of the history of the university.
Okay, right. I've got a question for you.
Yes.
To wit, we just celebrated the 60th anniversary this last week of Lutheran Campus Ministry at the corner of Wright and Chalmers, and I was asking Steve, the campus pastor who was there in the mid-1970s, Walt Johnson, had written up an historical account of Lutheran Campus Ministry and how it was that we came to form a congregation in the midst of a time of great anti-establishment fervor. But he said that in 1911, the first Lutheran Campus Ministry took place in... They met all over town. They met in a parsonage. They met in rented space over a post office. And at one point they met in, quote, the university chapel. Was there such a thing?
Well, in the first 25 years of the university's history, there was a... room in the old main building that was there was a compulsory chapel at that time,
huh.
And students that room was referred to as a chapel. Later, though, chapel was ended in 1894. What happened later on is, for a time, the university allowed the use of university rooms for various religious groups to hold meetings. And one of the rooms was in the present Davenport Hall, the agricultural building. And I think a room in there was probably referred to as a chapel. But you're quite right. These various groups for a time had to find a place to worship, and they met in various different places around town or near to the campus very often.
Well, thank you very much for the call and for the information.
I'm glad to listen. Thank you.
And we look forward to the third volume of your history, Professor Winton Solberg.
I will get back to something, though, even though I was teasing you about the fact that I'm female doesn't mean that I'm interim, but there is a relationship. Interim ministry really had grown up. The last 20 years or so has come into its own as a viable ministry of the church, and many women have found ourselves in the place of serving interims, part-time or temporary, and are able to serve in that way in places where we, you know, since we're not the real pastor, then people will accept us easily. And we've paved the way for people to call settled pastors. You know, it's not quite as frightening to allow a female pastor in if she's only going to be there for a while. And then people come around.
I think what I was, the line of thought I was trying to follow, and I didn't express it well at all, but I was trying to think whether you as a female pastor might have more sensitivity to issues like what was faced by the textile workers, who were mainly women in this country, and I think still are around other places. At the Y last week, we had the second in a series of three talks by people representing the corporations that the university licenses, gives authority to create the university sweatshirts and T-shirts and things with the university logo on them. They're now all made in the third world. And the problem is the university has standards and says, if you're going to make our stuff, then these textile workers must be paid a living wage. They must have decent working conditions. But the problem is, how do you enforce it? And these the companies that hire the other companies to produce these things say, okay, here are the standards, you got to meet them, but how do you enforce it? And the company may be in China today and in Indonesia tomorrow, or India the third day. And so it's quite an interesting problem. And some students at the Y who have been part of a group that's concerned about this have been on the chancellor's task force to try to work with some of these companies and set up ways so that there can be justice for the people who are making these products that have the university's name on them.
And
as I say, many, probably 95% from the last I heard, are female. And I was earlier trying to get around to the idea was, you're one of the first who's talked about these issues on the show, and I wondered if maybe you were more sensitive because these are other women.
Well,
maybe.
Yeah, on my better days. I'm very, you know, globalization has a number of blessings, but one of the real troubling things is the erosion of rights for workers in this country and the lack of rights, very basic things that the labor movement in this country got started by, you know, through blood, sweat, and tears 100 years ago, the end to child labor and things like the weekend and the eight-hour day and the things that were hard, the victories that were hard won in this country have never been won overseas and are endangered all around.
It's interesting. It's interesting to me hearing these discussions and these public meetings that have been taking place at the Y on certain Wednesday noons. Is that many of the corporations, huge corporations, are very concerned about this and seem to be really trying hard. But some of the economic forces in play make it very difficult, particularly in countries, as you say, where there isn't a history of organized labor.
Well, there was an interesting, I read a long article in a recent issue of The New Yorker about the world's water supply, asking, is the world going to run out of water? And it was really depressing for about two-thirds of the article, and then at the end it came around with surprise. And it talked about there's an identifiable curve, and I'm not an economist, and I don't remember what the name of the curve is, but evidently in a third world country, you get a little development and the standard of living quickly goes down, and then it starts to rise again, and it rises beyond what it was before. So if you can live through the worst part, you can get to a better part. What was particularly intriguing was they talked about the tendency in the 20th century to build giant dams, like the Three Gorges Dam in China that's under construction, and the sense that the way you get water for people is to build giant dams. But they weren't thinking about other kinds of possibilities, one of which has revolutionized water usage is drip irrigation and forms of conservation that nobody was thinking about. And so we don't know different ways of framing the labor issues that might lead to some real breakthroughs.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Reverend Julie Ryan, who is the interim pastor at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church and director of the Lutheran Campus Center. We're talking about issues of justice and beauty under the rubric Bread and Roses. We'll be talking more about that in a moment. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Let me encourage listeners who would like to join the conversation to jot down these numbers. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number that listeners may use if they're outside of the Champaign-Urbana local calling area. And you may be listening to this program live on the Internet at WILL.UIUC.EDU on AM 580 WILL. And so if so, do use that 800 number to call in. In Champaign-Urbana, there's a local, several local lines you can access by punching 333-9455 into your phone. That's 333-WILL. These Keeping the Faith programs are supported in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y has been on this campus since 1873. It was started by students responding to a Civil War colonel who, after the war, was starting Ys on different university campuses for students and came through this part of Illinois. And since that time, the Y has been helping develop student leaders by providing opportunities for social action, for community service. One of our most active programs is the Alternative Spring Break program, where we're sending over 250 college students on volunteer trips each year. They go all over the country and learn about issues like educational disparity, environmental issues, HIV/AIDS, Native American concerns, immigration issues. And the students study these, and then they go together in a group of 12 in two vans and may drive hundreds of miles over spring break or winter break or these days fall break or summer break as well for a week, and then do a service project related to that concern, and then come back and in this local community do another service project here that's tied to it as well. At any rate, the Alternative Spring Break program at the University of Y is doing a fundraiser next weekend on Over Dad's Day on Sunday. So after the Illinois victory at Purdue on Saturday, on Sunday morning you can get a good pancake breakfast. It's going to be at McKinley Foundation on the second floor there between 9 and 1:30. So after 9 o'clock, basically all morning, stop by and get some all-you-can-eat pancakes as well as fruit juice and coffee. Tickets are $5 at the door. So do stop by. If you're on the quad this week, you might see an ASB booth, and you can get a ticket for $4 there. Save a buck. But it's a very good project, and the group will use that money to help pay for expenses to make these trips doing service projects. So again, come to McKinley Foundation. That's 809 South 5th, the corner of 5th and Daniel in Champaign, next Sunday, November 12, between 9 and 1:30 in the morning for a fundraiser pancake breakfast. Coming up to Y this week on Tuesday, Chancellor Richard Herman will be speaking about the Imagining the University of the Future. What will the Illinois campus be like 50 years from now? Chancellor Herman will be speaking at noon at the Y, November 7. That's this Tuesday. It's a free lecture. You can order lunch if you like from our Thai eatery. Good food from Thailand. Call 337-1500 to make a reservation. Or if you forget, just show up. We'll find you food, I promise. That's this Tuesday, Chancellor Herman. This coming Friday, the last in our series for this semester on the environmental issues, Friday Forum at the Y, noon on Friday, November 10, James Herkert will be our speaker from the Nature Conservancy of Illinois on the problem of conserving the Earth's biodiversity. So that's the lecture on this Friday, November 10, also a free lecture. It's quite possible to come by public transportation easily to the Y. We're just down the street from the University Library bus stop. And you can also sometimes find parking about noon as students are taking off for the afternoon, some of them. Well, let's get back to our guest today. We're talking with Julie Ryan who is a pastor at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church on campus. Julie, you did a service at the Lutheran Seminary a couple years back that used bread and roses as a theme, and I'm sure that since I was able to see the outline for that service and read your sermon on that day, I'm sure that service caused quite a stir because it had so many different interesting parts and came together, I thought, so well. Tell me how you planned it.
Oh, well, I was working at our ELCA seminary in Hyde Park, the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, and I was part of the preaching rotation. Everybody on the staff or faculty would have a week when they were the coordinator for a team. And I happened to get March 8th, which caused me great glee because it's International Women's Day. And the gospel for the day is people telling Jesus, Pharisees telling Jesus to get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you. Jesus says, go tell that fox. You know, forget it. How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. So it was International Women's Day. You have Jesus identifying with the mother hen, female imagery. Who could ask for anything more? So I'm not sure that it really caused a stir. Well, and the student team who was looking at the week as a whole was during the season of Lent, and so we were looking at our fears and going along the journey of Lent, and so all of those different things were woven together. And what's striking is that Jesus identifies in the face of Herod the fox. He identifies instead with the fierceness of the mother hen, the vulnerable one, the female one, in fact. So we had the license plate, my bread and roses T-shirt as art for the day, and I sang bread and roses, and then at the end we passed out. We had a loaf of bread that people could break a hunk off, and we gave everyone a rose.
A memorable service, I'm sure. Was that model of you as a staff member of the seminary working with a student team to plan the service, is that something that's commonly done at the seminary these days?
With the faculty, yes. With the staff, no. We have some labor. Well, that's another, you know, the church is really great for telling the rest of the world how to act, but, you know, there are some class issues within our own house.
We have another caller joining the conversation on local line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
I called before, but I said you're talking about fears, and I have a great fear about gas and water. And can you speak to that, please? And I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Well, some of the environmental lecturers that we've heard at the Y this semester on Fridays have certainly talked about the energy issues and the problems with that and how dependent we are upon foreign oil. And just last week we had a very interesting talk on Will the World Run Out of Water by Professor Chai-Min Kai from Civil Environmental Engineering. And, of course, the former senator from Illinois, Paul Simon, last book was on the shortage of water that seems inevitable in our world, with increasing use, increasing population, and a limited resource.
Although, if I could just jump in for a sec, in the New Yorker article, it documented that water usage in this country has dropped 25%, surprisingly. And that's because of some things that weren't anticipated years ago. And in that same New Yorker article, it quoted someone who builds dams by saying that, you know, in engineering school, this was a generation ago, they taught us how to build giant things. They taught us how to build dams. They didn't teach us how to think differently. And, you know, songs like Bread and Roses or Women in the Ministry or the things that capture our imagination, the metaphors that help us to think in new ways are what will help us beyond our fears and may help us with the seemingly intransigent issues of labor and justice.
When some of the campus ministers here at the University of Illinois joined some graduate students a few years back who were trying to form a graduate employee organization and we're trying to form a union to do collective bargaining with the university, since so many of the graduate students here teach undergraduate courses. It was interesting seeing response from people in congregations either on campus or off campus or scattered around the state, because labor issues are still very touchy. Have you had any involvement in those kind of things? I know when of course you weren't here when, but your predecessor John Sutherland was one of those pastors who joined the graduate students who were marching to show solidarity and trying to gather support from other students and faculty administrators here. So I know he was involved in that issue. Did you hear anything about it on this campus when you came? You may be too new for that.
I was quite struck driving into town by the billboards saying, you know, how many graduate students can't afford health insurance for their families, things like that. I knew, you know, and we live in the western suburbs. I'm commuting back and forth by half weeks, and I've certainly read in the paper about the organizing efforts here. I haven't been involved in them. I've been mostly like trying to stay employed myself. But, you know, I think in whatever setting we find ourselves, we can advocate for justice and we can take a look at power relationships and be alert to them and try to change sometimes in very subtle ways.
What are some of the resources that you found helpful in the Christian faith as you think about these issues when you were preparing that service for the Lutheran Seminary worship service, that gathering? Did you select the scripture yourself? Was that assigned to you?
No, it was part of the lectionary.
It was for that
day.
Yeah,
the rhythm of the, you know, we talk about bread and roses. Those are things that have been around for as long as the human race has. They're very ancient, simple things, and our liturgical tradition uses the simplest things of our life: bread, wine, water, candles, touch, oil, the things that they're not high tech. You don't have to have specialized knowledge. They're very simple. They're very common. And yet, one writer has said, these words hold up the sky. And so, let's see, where was I?
We were just talking about resources that have kind of helped you come to think about these
things. Oh, I was going to say, the rhythm of the church year connects us to the earth. Now, it's very closely correlated with the seasons in the Northern Hemisphere, so Christians who live in the South have had to work on some alternative ways of working with the cultural imperialism of the Northern symbolism. But our seasons connect us with the earth, and the rhythm of all of us sharing the same lectionary, the same appointed reading through the course of the year. We share the lectionary passages not only with other Lutherans, but with Roman Catholics, Episcopalians, Methodists, Presbyterians. It's a way of being part of something larger than ourselves. And so when we went to plan the service, part of it was, okay, we're in the season of Lent. We're using these particular readings that are appointed. And then within that, reaching out to the secular calendar where, so being part of something that's ordered, that gives a rhythm, which is, again, connected to the beauty. Songs and words themselves, the language of the liturgy, the language of the songs, the beauty brings us order and meaning in the midst of chaos. And that's tremendously important.
Lutherans seem particularly good at appreciating beauty, both musical beauty with the music in your worship services, and even architectural beauty. The St. Andrew's Chapel is very simple and not elaborate or extravagant at all, but it has that simple beauty that I find very appealing. And I think Lutheran churches are noted for their appreciation for contemporary architecture, which many churches are not. But often the Lutheran church in a town will be the one that has the most interesting architecture I've discovered in my travels. Let's talk a little bit about how you have come to this place as an interim pastor. Did you grow up in a religious home?
No. Grew up in Santa Monica and a non-church-going family. I was taught that religion was the breeding ground for prejudice and a place where you needed to check your brain at the door. But somehow my sister, who is 15 years older than I, was working on her doctorate, and she and her husband, who were religious, hadn't checked their brains at the door. One day they brought me to campus ministry at UCLA, and it was in the late 60s, and just one taste of that was very powerful, and I got very involved. I should say I had a little bit of I'm not sure whether release time religious instruction is even legal anymore, but we did it in California.
So.
I started, and the effect of having religion forbidden in the home made it endlessly fascinating. Mm. So, you know, how do you rebel in a household like that? You get very involved in church. I was baptized at St. Monica's when I was 10, and then got very involved.
Was that a Lutheran church?
St. Monica's? No. Roman Catholic.
Catholic, okay.
Yeah. And I was very happy as a Roman Catholic. Then got very involved in Roman Catholic campus ministry at UCLA, run by the Paulist Fathers who specialize in communication and campus ministry, and had a very strong experience of people who took the gospel seriously. It shaped their lives. We were part of a covenant community out of which have emerged a number of lifetime friendships, marriages, religious vocations. Came out in the mid-1970s to Chicago to go to graduate school, thinking, you know, I caught a vision at that point of wanting to be a priest and thought that the Vatican would change, and of course it did. Little did we know, but came out to do graduate work at the University of Chicago in 1977. And
in what field?
History of religions, comparative religions. Actually, in 1973, I had been among the first students to major in the study of religions at UCLA. That was a new program at that public university, mm-hmm. which was interdepartmental and really a forerunner of religious programs where you had to take courses in different religions, different disciplines, different languages, so that you had a feel. And that was at the height of Vietnam, you know, when people in the then administration had no clue about Buddhism and would say very stupid things about, well, those people don't have any regard for human life. You know, had we known more about Buddhism, could we have done something different in Vietnam? Had we known something more about Islam, could the world be a different place now? So I came out to do graduate study in history of religions, fell between a few departmental cracks, took a leave of absence, lived with nuns, thought I'd be a nun, was warmly received, became the church secretary at the Lutheran Seminary in Hyde Park, where the campus ministry resided, ended up singing the Easter proclamation at the Lutheran Easter Vigil when the guy who was designated didn't show up. And all those years, people had said, well, you know, why don't you just become a Protestant if you want to be a minister? And I hadn't wanted to. But that night, I thought, well, you know, maybe God's trying to tell me something. So I switched over, and I had my first congregation was had been an experimental community in the then Lutheran Church in America. But when I left there, my real goal all along was campus ministry. Then I fell in love with someone with small children and instead got married and took care of them, but got put on the state board where the funds for campus ministry just kept getting cut and cut and cut. And, you know, our church keeps talking about needing to reach out to people of that generation at the same time that the funds are cut. And this just, Father Tim Hallett, who will be on your show in a couple of weeks, was saying, you know, it's like eating the seed corn. So anyway, my position at the seminary had been eliminated in June, and in mid-July, I got this phone call saying, can you serve the interim? And I leapt at the chance. Mm.
We're talking with Julie Ryan, who's the interim pastor at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church on the corner of Wright and Chalmers, right across the street from the University Y. I can say that address very easily. If you'd like to join the conversation, do give us a call, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. So, Julie, did your parents, who were not religious, find your involvement in the Catholic Church and then now in the Lutheran Church strange?
Well, my father was long since dead.
I see.
And my mother actually was relieved, who was raised Catholic and had a bad experience, was relieved when I did become a Lutheran.
I see.
Because because the family ties were looser, the transition was easier.
Mm-hmm. We do have a caller on line number one. Go ahead.
I find Pastor Ryan's biographical statement very, very interesting. Since she was at Lutheran Seminary in Chicago, which is strong in dealing with the interface between religion and science, I wonder mm-hmm. if she could talk about what she ran into there, Phil Hefner and other people who are working along those lines.
Religion and science.
Well, Phil would get us in class to think in systematic theology about the scientific implications in ways that left me just at the brink of wonder, at the brink of prayer at the end of a class session. I think this is, and, you know, Antje Jakelin, his successor at the Zygon Center for Religion and Science, has just been elected the Bishop of Lund, Sweden. So,
oh, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think she's going off in March. But I think, you know, these are the questions that we encounter transcendence and wonder, the stuff of religion, in contemplating the universe and I think the scientific questions are of the essence.
Zygon recently reviewed a book by a woman named Nancy Murphy, I think, deals with this interface between science and religion. I don't know that you know that book at all.
I don't. I've been reading Brian Greene's The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Nature of Reality. He's a physicist who can write for the rest of us.
Well, we'll have to follow this up later. I'll come around and meet you.
Okay.
Okay, fine. Bye. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much. Zygon is a fascinating journal that does deal with religion and science. And that's spelled Z-Y?
Z-Y-G-O-N, Greek mm-hmm. word meaning yoke.
Yoke. The yoke is light. Let's talk a little bit about something else at the Lutheran Seminary, and that is you have a long history there of a conversation between Christians and Muslims, and have someone on your faculty who is himself Muslim and teaches at the Islamic Center in Chicago and also at the Lutheran Seminary. Did you happen to get involved in any of that discussion? I recently heard him speak. That's how I happen to know him.
Just tangentially. Uh-huh. I put on a conference on interfaith relations a couple of years ago.
But Lutheran school.
We had, I will say, a couple of years ago, we had half a dozen Muslim students from Turkey enroll. Their mentor is getting his Doctor of Ministry through the ecumenical Doctor of Ministry program that we share with Catholic Theological Union and McCormick. And then the other members of the group are men who were getting their master's and did graduate in June. And they are all scholars of religion at home, but they wanted to learn about Christianity from other Christians. They're being sponsored by the Niagara Foundation, which is interested in interfaith understanding. And it transformed our campus to have the Muslim students and their wives in our midst because, you know, we would need to observe, we'd need to allow them to use the prayer chapel for their prayers at designated times. And when we'd have banquets, we'd need to make sure that we weren't serving pork. But, you know, just as they become better Muslims, we become better Christians. Mm. We had a number of conversations, and for instance, one night we were talking about sacred scripture, and they have such reverence for the book, and they're taking classes, and they're very nice, and they were taking Bible classes, and you know, seeing the rest of us scribbling notes in the margin and putting the Bible on the floor and other things that just you'd never mark on, you know, just really set their teeth on edge in one sense, and yet they could laugh about it with us. And seeing their response to how we treat our physical book makes us think about the practice of our faith in different ways, mm-hmm. stretches us.
We have another caller on line number one, local line one. Go ahead. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Regarding bread, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Regarding bread, and that has to do a lot with public policy, is there any way that we can influence public policy as a church without getting into the religion versus government area?
Well, our guest today at worship was Pastor Dan Schwick, who is the Director for Advocacy for Lutheran Social Services of Illinois. And they have a whole program that helps people of faith to work with legislators to work toward equitable wages, health care, you know, responding to the gospel in such a way that we make a real difference in the lives of people who are poor and oppressed.
Thanks.
There are several ecumenical groups, such as Protestants for the Common Good, that also try to educate legislators about issues of concern to Protestant Christians in ways that are very different from what we often hear on the media as the Christian point of view. There are folks on the left who are progressive and liberal who are trying to have a voice from a Christian perspective in this case, in other cases from an interfaith perspective. But Protestants for the Common Good in Chicago and the state of Illinois is very concerned with having a voice. Religious groups, given nonprofit status, cannot endorse particular candidates, but we certainly can speak up on issues legally. And I know the Lutheran Church, you mentioned Lutheran Social Services, and they have a public advocate who does that, you were just saying. Julie, we're down to our last minute or so in this program. When you try to think of beauty, and I guess there's so much in this world that is also ugly. How do you, as a Christian pastor, affirm the beauty and yet be aware and not turn away from the things in the world that really are ugly and evil? Just a small question.
Well, think of the prophet Amos says, has God saying, "I hate, I despise your feasts. Take away from me the sound, the smell of incense, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." But how is God speaking? God is speaking in words of poetry. God is speaking through words that themselves sing. And it's the words that sing that arouse pictures in our minds that are what change us. And singing and telling stories and nourishing our spirit is what gives us the resources in our souls that we need to do the hard work.
Well, that's a perfect place to close the program. We've been talking with Julie Ryan, who is the pastor, interim pastor at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church at the University of Illinois campus on Wright and Chalmers. What time is your service on Sundays?
Oh, 10 o'clock every Sunday.
And it's open to students, but other people can come as well.
Yeah.
Great. And if people have a question for you, what phone number is a good one to use?
217-344-1593.
Well, thank you for being our guest on Keeping the Faith, and thank you for those who called in with questions and comments and information to share. My name is Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for Keeping the Faith. Next week, I'll be pleased to be interviewing Gail Haravan, an Israeli who will be talking with us about the secular religious divide in present-day Israel. John Paul Buzard from the Buzard Pipe Organ Company will be talking about building pipe organs for churches and synagogues on November 19 on Keeping the Faith, and Father Tim Hallett will be our guest on November 26. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith, and remember the pancake breakfast at McKinley Foundation next Sunday from 9 o'clock. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Andrew Sullivan is not a Republican, but he calls himself a conservative. He does not believe in using religion to ground political ideals, but he himself is a person of faith. And he endorsed John Kerry, though Ronald Reagan is one of his heroes. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Andrew Sullivan and the Fight for the Conservative Soul. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853.
The midterm elections are coming up. Americans will be choosing 33 senators, 36 governors, and all 435 members of the House of Representatives. NPR will be keeping tabs on what matters most to voters as they get ready to go to the polls. I'm Robert Siegel. From now through November 7th, join us for full coverage of the 2006 midterm elections on the air and online from NPR News.
Follow national, state, and local election coverage here on WILL Urbana.